Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. So tonight, our guest speaker is Vanessa Abel, and Vanessa's been practicing with us at Canando for a few years, and before that, she practiced a lot in the UK, and today she's going to be talking about loss, and I think about grieving, and after her talk, we'll have some time to ask her some Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie. Good evening, everybody. This evening I would like to talk about loss. Not so much loss and grieving in the sense of losing people close to us, but loss in the kind of wider sense of loss. As a term, I've been thinking about loss quite a lot, obviously, these last couple of months, I think, ever since we had to close the physical Zendo at Canando. That felt like a big loss to me. So the first thing I wanted to share with you was an experience I had that's sort of connected with this. As some of you know, I'm studying on a 1-year program for an introduction to Buddhist chaplaincy. And as such, we have a class that meets every month. And every month there's a theme to the class when we come together. And back in December, when we met, the theme for the class was renunciation. And so often there'll be a talk and then we'll do some kind of exercise together that explores the subject. So on this particular day, the teacher who was taking the class asked us to cut out several pieces of paper and to write down things on them that were important to us. And he broke them down into 4 separate categories. And the categories were objects, activities, the roles or the relationships that we have in our life, and people. And for each category, I can't remember now, but I think we wrote maybe like 4 or 5 different things onto separate pieces of paper. And then we laid these pieces of paper in front of us, and it became an exercise in renunciation. So we were asked to, predictably, we were asked to take one of the things out of each column. And it was a very good exercise in reflection in terms of the things that we felt that we could let go of, how it felt to make those kinds of decisions. But then the activity had a second part that was much more surprising to myself and everybody. And if you could imagine, we were sort of sitting in a circle as a class and everybody had to put their pieces of paper, what was left of the things that we hadn't taken. So these were probably the most important things that were down on these pieces of paper. And then the teacher just started coming around the circle and randomly just taking the pieces of paper away from people. And it was a really surprising experience to watch him go around, and he did it very slowly. And I was somewhere near the end of the circle, so I was one of the last people he came to, and I got to watch everybody else have something taken away from them. And the closer he came to me, I really began to really be clear to me the things that were really important to me, and I found myself really holding on to and wishing and praying and as though it were real that, you know, that the most important things to me would not get taken away. And about 3 people before me, the teacher stood in front of one of my classmates And he just picked up all her papers and took them, everything she had. And there was this kind of gasp that went around the circle, because everybody felt it. You know, I think by that point, you know, we'd come to the point of considering these things and considering the idea of loss and uncontrolled loss, things that we couldn't, things that we were losing, not renouncing, but things that were being taken away from us. So it was a really powerful exercise, and I'd recommend, if you know, for a group, I guess you'd need at least three or four people to do something like that. But it's it really kind of, you get to dig deep in terms of figuring out your priorities. And afterwards, when we talked about it, a lot of people commented that they felt some kind of relief after he had passed as well. So that the hardest part was almost the anticipation or the anxiety before the things were taken, and worrying about what was going to be taken. And then once he passed, well, there was nothing else you could do. That was then a moment of beginning to build acceptance. So this was a really good lesson. And I suppose, you know, this idea, the suffering, that the pain that we feel at the prospect of loss is it's the first noble truth, is the truth of suffering. And at the heart of that suffering is the difficulty that we have in accepting impermanence. We have difficulty with it because we have an illusion of permanence. And when I think about it, I feel like that that concept of things not changing works on two levels for us. I think there's the level that I just talked about, when you know that you will die, that the people around you will die, that the things that you are doing will pass, that everything's going to change at some point. But and you can accept it to a certain point, but it's really hard to live the reality of that on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's kind of one level of illusion, is that we have to keep reminding ourselves, or I do. I keep forgetting that fact over and over again. I have to remind myself. And I think the other level of kind of illusion of impermanence for me, of permanence for me, is in myself. And that's much, much deeper and much harder to really see and come to terms with, is this continuity of a person that has existed and supposedly continued for the last 43 years. But understanding the real substance of that is different to, I think, for me at least, what my day-to-day experience of being that person is. And I think our practice and a lot of the things we learn when we study Zen and we study Buddhism is about seeing through that veneer. But what I've also discovered is that you can practice for years, for a really long time, and think that you've sort of nailed impermanence and change, and that you've come to terms with it and you're good with it. And then something traumatic happens, and you realize that you're not at all. A couple of years ago, my cat died just out of the blue. My cat bit the cable on the back of my TV and electrocuted himself, and we weren't expecting that to happen. And I was absolutely blindsided by this. I thought I was ready for major people in my life to leave me. I didn't realize I wasn't even ready for my pet to leave me. So that was a big lesson for me, and a big wake up call. And ever since, with my study group, on my chaplaincy course, since we did that exercise back in December, one of my classmates has had to leave the course because his wife was diagnosed with very advanced terminal cancer. And our last class was on Zoom, and he came and joined us to to tell us the same thing that he'd been practicing for years and years. And he thought that he was ready for change, and he thought he was ready for loss. And he explained how it felt to be humbled by the understanding that he wasn't at all. So I've come to realize that, at least for myself, my relationship with loss is a key point of my practice. And in some ways, I've also tried to examine how my relationship with Buddhism and Buddhist teaching might have impacted, and maybe negatively impacted, my relationship with loss and grieving. Because as part of the Buddhist teaching, we're taught that attachment is not a good thing. So if you grieve something after it's gone, if I lose my phone and I get upset about it, well, that's just not cool, because that obviously means that I had some kind of attachment to it. And that feels, that doesn't feel right. It almost feels shameful. So I try to examine that and to bear that in mind, because I think if you do that, there's the danger that you don't acknowledge your losses and that you don't fully hold your grief. And today I came across a story of it's a story from Tibetan Buddhism. Maybe you're familiar with it. I'd never heard it before, but it's a teacher who was a translator called Marpa, and he was a very important teacher in the history of Tibetan Buddhism. And he had one son who was his heir, and his son died. And I'll just read out the little paragraph that followed. He was weeping bitterly, covering his head with his robe, and his students came to see him. They'd heard that his son had died, and they were concerned for him, and they were perplexed by the power of his grief, because this was the teacher that had been teaching them that death was an illusion, and that suffering came because of attachment. And yet there he was, absolutely distraught, beside himself with grief. And so they asked him, they sort of confronted him and said, well, you told us one thing, but you're acting in a very different way. And he replied to them, yes, death is an illusion, and the death of one's child is an even greater illusion. So I think for me, the important point is that we have to be attentive to ourselves and kind to ourselves, because loss is a kind of a rupture, and it creates a wound. I don't necessarily even mean from losing somebody or a person, a very traumatic, heavy loss, but even small losses, small things like Canada closing is a kind of loss. And the pain of a loss, it arises from attachment, and maybe it arises from a kind of ignorance. So in the same way that like a child would put their hand in the fire, not knowing that it was hot, but they still get burned, and that pain is still as real. And the healing still has to occur. And the way to heal is through kindness and paying attention to something and not ignoring it, not pushing it down. So when my cat died, I took a week off. I literally just stopped everything for a week. And I grieved. And my practice helped me during that week, I think precisely for that, precisely because I think I was able to say, okay, I'm gonna be with this feeling. Like, this feeling has absolutely blown me over, but it's really important that I stay with it and examine it and feel it deeply. And so I did. So talking about how can we practice with loss right now? You know, how can we practice with loss before some major trauma or some major upset happens in our lives? How can we really prepare ourselves for it through our practice? So every time we sit, we meditate, and we meditate on impermanence, on things that are constantly changing. There are some traditions within Buddhism that suggest diving in much deeper. There are some practices in meditation of like death meditation, that are a very strong experience, where, you know, people sit. I don't know if anyone's ever done one, but you'll sit and you'll be taken through the stages, for example, of your own death as a guided meditation, and it's a very strong thing to confront and very powerful. And maybe you don't always feel ready to go straight there. So another thing I often think about is starting with the small things, you know, starting with all the tiny, tiny little losses and the medium-sized losses and the medium to large-sized losses that happen on a daily basis. And it's something that I think about as cultivating as an art. So some of you might know the poem by Elizabeth Bishop called One Art. And it's sort of humorous. I'm just going to read the first few lines of it. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost, that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost doorkeys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster. Places and names and where it was you meant to travel, none of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. It goes on. So I think that when we talk about impermanence in Zen, and when impermanence is presented in Zen, often it's presented as something much, much smaller and a lot less dramatic. That can be very Zen style. And I came across one of Dogen's very short poems, one of his short poems that are called Wakas. They're just three lines long. And this one's on impermanence. And it simply says, the world, moonlit drops shaken from the crane's bill. So it's a very clear picture of a passing moment, of the kind of transience that happens with every split second. And that helps me. That helps me to really understand how loss can happen in every second, how things appear and disappear, how every time I leave my daughter at school, it's a kind of loss, it's a little loss, or every time I say goodbye to anybody, or at the end of every day, or even in meditation at the end of every breath. You know, that's something we can do like very tangibly. Feel a breath come and feel a breath go. And really understand what it means that breath will never come back again. And when we pay attention to the rising and falling of things, we realize that they are all cut of the same cloth, and that loss doesn't have to be the death of a loved one lurking in the future. It's right here with us now. and we can practice with it at this very moment. And it's a sort of a relieving thought. I think that's the quality of relief that my classmates expressed after the exercise that we did. I think in that moment we sort of realized that so much of suffering and so much of the pain is in the anticipation as well. And I'm sure you're all familiar with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's 5 stages of loss, but I'll repeat them for you anyway. So they are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, in no particular order. And obviously these are always cited, you know, in situations where people are grieving heavily. But I think that these are, you know, depression, acceptance, denial, anger. I mean, these are probably things that we experience on a daily basis in a micro form. And I think when we meet these states, you know, we can observe where they came from, like where they arose from, and what, if you begin to see them, like even on a micro level as a reaction to loss, I think it can also bring you, I think it can bring us, brings me closer. I might not even realize that I've lost something. I might not even realize that some kind of transition has happened today, and that's my response to it. Is that maybe I feel angry today because I lost something, but I haven't really even told myself about it yet. And I think that it just makes great inroads into understanding how we lose and the nature of loss and how we hold our grief, how we deal with our grief. And I was thinking about a quote from Suzuki that Travis mentioned a couple of weeks ago, when somebody asked him, why do people have such a problem with telling the truth? And he said, maybe it's because we don't suffer enough. Maybe that's why we have a problem with honesty. And it came up again recently in another one of our discussions when we were talking about the relationship between suffering and compassion, how suffering stimulates compassion, how suffering gives rise to compassion. So I think the more we're acquainted with loss, the more fertile the ground of our being is for growing compassion. And so I can't not read another poem on that note. And this will, I'll end with this poem. So this poem is possibly one that you've heard previously as well. It's called Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever before you learn the tender gravity of kindness. You must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore, only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is you I have been looking for. And then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. I think the four lines that really stand out for me in that poem are when she says, you must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. It makes me think of this image of this cloth that covers everybody, you know, the size of the cloth. It kind of reminds me of the mustard seed parable, I guess, of, I don't know if anybody doesn't know it, but the lady who, it's a Buddhist story about a woman who lost her child. And she was inconsolable. And then the Buddha recommended, he said to her that she could be cured of her grief if she went and collected a mustard seed from every house in the village that hadn't lost somebody, that hadn't suffered a loss themselves. So every house that hadn't suffered a loss, they would give her a mustard seed. And obviously, you know, she didn't collect a single seed because every door she knocked on had suffered a loss. And then she had the realization that this loss was, this suffering, this human condition was something that she shared with everybody. It makes me think, Teresa and Kaizen, of your Under the Same Sky project. You know, under the same cloth, under the same sky. Thank you. Anyone wants to make a comment or share some experiences, please?
Dave?
Vanessa, you mentioned the whole idea of suffering and the extent to which it is part of the participation of the actual event that seems to be the root cause of our suffering. And I think also there's just part of that, our suffering can be our memory of that event as well, both the anticipation and the memory. I had a very striking experience of that some years ago. Maybe some of you have also had this experience. I had a surgical procedure that I was really not looking forward to. You know, it's kind of scary. And so I was, the anticipation of that was not very pleasant. And I asked them if they were going to completely put me under during the procedure. And they said, no, we need you to be conscious and cooperative during this. And so we're not going to completely put you under. And that, of course, increased my anxiety looking forward to the procedure. And so I was quite struck by the fact that in the lead up to the procedure, the anesthesiologist started administering the anesthetic. And then the next thing I knew, I was waking up after the procedure. And I said, oh, so you knocked me out after all. And they said, oh, no, you were awake and you were cooperative during the procedure. I said, really, what was it like for me? And they said, well, you experienced a fair amount of discomfort during the procedure. And I couldn't remember any of it at all. And it was so striking that it really reinforced for me the reality that our suffering is, in a sense, really more in our memory of it than in the actual suffering in the moment. It really literally felt and still feels like that discomfort in the moment was experienced by somebody else. It wasn't really me. And that whole notion of our suffering being in our memory seems so intimately tied up with the illusion of the continuity of ourself, strung like a string of beads on a string, from moment to moment, and it makes ourself seem not only so permanent, but it's intimately related to the way that we suffer through the memory of that same person, that same me, in another moment suffering. Anyway, I just wanted to share that. Diane nodding, and I know from her medical background, she's probably quite familiar with what I'm talking about, and probably some of you have also experienced this. But for those of you who haven't, all I can say is it's an incredibly striking phenomenon to experience, that something that you are told and you know you experienced, you physically, your physical body, seems to have literally happened to somebody else because you can't remember it.
Thank you. I did have a similar experience with my wisdom teeth this year, where I think they gave me enough drugs to knock out a horse. And supposedly I was awake, and there was videotaped evidence to support that, but I don't remember a single thing. But I did wonder afterwards, you know, like, is there something in me that's holding the trauma of that experience? I don't know, like on a physical level, I don't know. I felt the same. I thought, I came out feeling like, I feel like I should, like the hangover from that experience should be much heavier than it was. And it didn't feel right. If I could do it again, I would choose not to have been knocked out to the extent that I was. Yeah. Ken.
Hi. Nice talk. Hello. Thank you very much. Can you hear me? I don't know if I've got my mic on.
Yes.
Yes? Okay.
Yeah.
This may sound a little silly, but there is or are two kinds of losses, right? There's a loss that we don't want to have be or have take place. But I can't but believe all of us would like to lose this virus that's in our environment, but it's still something that's going away out of our control. I'm not sure where I'm going to go there, but it is kind of the same lost coin. In one side of it, we have a lot of sayings and all the beautiful things you said there to try to comfort us with that loss. But the other side of loss, we'll be dancing in the street when that happens, maybe 6 feet away just by habit, but you know, it'll be glorious when that virus is gone. I'll be happy to lose it.
Yeah,
that's about as profound as I can be tonight, actually.
Will there be anything you miss from this period, do you think?
Oh, probably. There's a certain element of the I guess they begin to call it loneliness now, everybody always being by themselves. I kind of knew I was going into a time before this thing came up that I was going to go in and probably be by myself a lot. And I kind of prepared a little bit for it. I had done it a couple of decades ago, kind of go that withdrawal. And so I kind of knew what would happen. And, you know, there would be friends reaching out and such like that. But it is the kind of the solitude. You can either say I'm lonely and I miss everybody, or I've got a degree of solitude here that I can explore. I can do something that I will not be interrupted while I do it, and it'll be great and all of that. So this is kind of a growing period of time for me. That's it.
Nick. Hey, Vanessa, can you tell us more about your cat?
Yeah. I feel like lots of people at Canada have heard me talk about my cat a lot, and my still my surviving cat who's still around. What would you like to know?
I don't know, just like what was really special about your cat. Just the reason I ask is like I'm a huge cat lover too, and my cats, they always sit zazen with me. So yeah, just when you brought up the loss of your cat, like it really struck me. So I'd love to hear more about your cat. Maybe, I don't know, what did you learn from your cat about your practice?
Thank you. Thanks for asking that. Gosh, I learned so much from my cats. Cats are amazing. Cats experience. They just experience. There's no hesitation with cats. There's no like overanalyzing anything. Like they just do it. Yeah, this was like a rescue cat, and he was absolutely tiny when I first got him. I had him for about 8 years. So I think I developed a kind of a very like maternal relationship with him, like especially more than with my other cat. And he was very dog-like in that he was very, very personable. Like he really liked to be with people. He liked to sit on my shoulder whenever he could, or just like I put him in my sweatshirt. I could take him out. Like he was very, you know, he wasn't skittish like our other cat is. He was just a terror. He was an absolute terror. He used to do all sorts of things, but then I could, like, when my daughter was born, I could dress him up in her clothes, and you know, he didn't mind. he was just very chill. But he had this thing about chewing electric cables. And literally since he was a kitten, and we tried everything. It was written in his stars from the beginning, you know, but we put vinegar on the cables, we put like citrus juice, you know, all the things that cats traditionally wouldn't like. We covered them with musk, with like gaffer tape. And then when we moved to the States, I made sure that I bought furniture that was, you know, like cable covering type furniture where we could just put all the cables behind the furniture and the cats couldn't get to it. And I thought we were good. But he discovered this little like way of sneaking under the TV and chewing on the main cable that connected it to the main. And when I realized what had happened, and we found this cable, and it was like Swiss cheese. Like like, I mean, this had been a long project for him. You know, I didn't even realize this had been going on. So yeah, it was a big loss. I didn't anticipate how much I would grieve. And one of the ways of coping with it for me was just talking about it a lot with anybody who would listen, and trying to put aside this feeling of being a crazy cat woman and the judgments that would, you know, what people would think, like, just a cat, come on, get over it. But you feel what you feel. And that's what I felt. Yeah. His name was Quetzalcoatl. After the Mexican god Quetzalcoatl, Quetzi for short. And that's, I don't know if you can see him. That's him.
Oh. He's still on my phone. I can't. Oh, somebody told me that I would know the day when it was right to take him off my screensaver, but that day still hasn't come. Dinery.
Yeah, I was fascinated with the discussion of memory because it's been translated as one of the skandhas. I have Red Pine's translation of, or his work on the Heart Sutra, and you know, we say form, feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness, and he says memory instead of impulses. And I've been trying to, maybe you could give some, in, you know, your feelings about what is that fourth skanda? Is it memory or is it impulses, or why these two different words are being used? Because I haven't been able to really get a handle on that other than it's empty. And I was wondering if you've come across the same dilemma, and it's just fascinating in light of the idea that memories are just completely impermanent, and you know, this idea that it could be actually happening to somebody else, but for the fact that you can remember it.
I have not read that text. I'm not familiar with it. So I would actually like to hear more about it from you. The translation of impulses to memory.
Enough respect for him as a translator and the work that I'm sure he. Anyway, it maybe shows up as different. Either one of them could be seen as empty in the sense that, you know, something that we anticipate or we want to do or we have an intention to do could be seen as it dependent on memory. But it's, so it really kind of gets down to the nature of the skandhas as they were originally described by, you know, all throughout Buddhism, and what, how, you know, that's where the translations kind of struggle.
Mm-hmm. What was he using as his text? Like, was he using a bunch of different sources?
I have his book here, the Heart Sutra, which is he relies a lot on, I mean, it's an absolutely fascinating history, and he relies a lot on Chinese translations, as well as, you know, Chinese works, as well as the original Sanskrit. And so it's one of the things that I really was surprised, because there's, you know, obviously I've seen even within in the greater Sangha here, based on Suzuki Roshi's, I've seen different, teachings. I've seen different ways of talking about the skandhas. But he definitely says, no sensation, no perception, no memory, and no consciousness. Of course, starting with no form. So, anyway, it's just an interesting thing to get a handle on.
Right. I guess put in that context, I feel like memory would stand for, I don't know how it would replace impulse the way that I understand impulse, but that memory would stand for any kind of lasting impression, I suppose. Yeah, and any kind of lasting or maybe anticipatory impression that might jive more with impulse. I'm not sure, but it's, you know, the inner movie, basically, right? the projection that just keeps wearing. I guess that would be just my first reaction when you say it, but I'd be interested to read more about that.
I agree with you. I think so. You could see impulses dependent on a memory of something that you understand and how you want to change it. So,
yeah.
But to actually interpret the skandha as memory itself was kind of fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's interesting. Thank you.
Craig.
Hi there. Thanks for your talk, Vanessa. I just love listening to you speak. You could talk about anything. I was going to say something else. I just wanted to pick up one thing on the kind of impulses versus memory. The word that we use when we chant the Heart Sutra in English, and if with that fourth skandha, is formation. And so I feel like if you have like mental formations as sitting between the perceptions that you have and then the consciousness that you have of them, there's this notion of like kind of a construct that sits in between them. I also love this idea that it's synonymous in some way with the memory of it afterwards, or like that kind of construct and then the experience and the memory somehow are, I don't know. It's I hadn't heard the impulse word before, that skandha. And it does also go to show, I guess, the influence that your language and translations and your interpretations, pre-existing understanding of those words can have on how you read all this stuff. The thing I was going to say before was that there was a part where during your talk you said that you weren't necessarily aware yet that you were feeling a loss about something. And it made me think about what Anna wrote in Under the Same Sky, where she wrote, one thing I've learned from my sitting practice is that sometimes I feel things physically before I fully process my thoughts. Mm. So I thought there was a strong echo there. And connecting that as well to this notion of like a chain of links, I guess, in some ways, from like the true thing and then your experience of it. We talked about the after the fact thing with the memory of it, and if you disrupt that memory, what does that mean for, you know, the truth of it? Mm. I think the same thing with the anticipation. And I feel like maybe sometimes I don't fully understand that I'm anticipating something I haven't even lost yet. and that actually that is like the probably applies to a lot of things that can make you kind of upset or anxious. You haven't incurred the loss yet. It is that anticipation of it. Mm. And you're not even aware that you're living this specific loss before it's happened. The more you can peer under the cover of that, and so to borrow another word from Brenda's talk, get intimate with it, mm-hmm. then perhaps the more you can start to unpick the suffering that comes with it. So thanks for your talk. Thank you, Anna, in absentia, for your Under the Same Sky.
Yeah, I think I feel like, I mean, that if you take one like large transition being the transition into parenthood for a lot of people, for as an example, you know, and I feel like I've never really understood the potential of loss until my daughter was born, because I never experienced love the way that I experienced it towards her. And I think the moment that occurs, then the flip side of it also becomes evident, whether you are being aware of it regularly or not. And so I think so many of the anxieties that I probably impose upon her because of this, you know, great, great fear that lurks, that's always going to lurk under the surface. It's something that I feel anyway, that I always have to take care with and really work to be aware of and to understand, so as not to inflict damage. And Craig, I love listening to your voice as well. I don't think there's anyone in this group that doesn't love listening to your dulcet Scottish tones.
Teresa.
Let me
unmute you really quick. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Vanessa, for your talk. You know, a few years ago, Frank Ostaszewski came to Canondo. He really made an impression on me. Sometimes when I have the chance, I listen to some of his talks. So this week, I participated in a webinar that he made with John Halifax. And then the day after, I listened to one of his talks where he was saying, he said, don't wait. Don't wait. Waiting for the next moment, we lose this one or we miss this one. He said, don't wait. Dying folks taught me that. Mm. And I think that's the lesson from losing. When you lose, you learn to appreciate the current moment, what you have. So I guess that's a good thing that comes out of this crisis or of any loss. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thanks, Teresa. Was it Frank Ostaszewski that wrote, I feel like I saw this somewhere today, like the four things that people regret not having said, and that there was, will you forgive me? I forgive you. I love you. And I cannot remember what the fourth one was. I'll regret not remembering it. Does that ring a bell for anybody? I don't know.
Yeah, no, what he said on Wednesday, what he said during the webinar this week, he said, well, dying people, they don't regret, you know, not having accumulated enough, or, you know, the thing that when you're going to die, people think the most is, was I loved, and did I love well?
Umar?
Yeah, I have a halo behind me.
You're enlightened, that's what it looks like.
So I think what Vanessa was making a reference to was to Ho'oponopono, which is a Hawaiian saying, which when Fred Luskin came to Cannondale, he said, I think the saying goes something like, I'm sorry, please forgive me, thank you, and I love you. So that's what you were talking about.
He writes about forgiveness.
It's about forgiveness. Yeah. I'm taking a Chinese sort of medicine class right now with my teacher, and he keeps on saying one thing, you're going to go where you're coming from. And so I asked him, I said, what does that mean? He said, whatever happens, happens. And this is where our practice is great, because it comes in and knocks out the whole five stages and says, okay, just accept what happened and do what needs to be done. So he said, you know, if you come from a place of sadness, you're going to head towards sadness. So if you accept what has happened, which is, you know, coming in line with what is going on right now and moving away from suffering, and you start moving away from suffering and starting from, again, from acceptance, you will accept whatever comes your way. So he was, he just explained that to me the other day. I was taking a class with him, and it was interesting that it's just a part of body work. So just like we have to, and I said to him, what does this have to do with body work? He said, well, when you go and when you go and treat somebody or give them help them with the procedure, you can't go in sad. You can't go in with carrying something in your mind. You have to clear your mind and then go and help somebody, because if you carry that in and you do a procedure on somebody, you're going to actually give them that input. Mm-hmm. So he said, so just, you have to be careful with that too. He said, just carrying a certain thought can have an effect on how you do a procedure on somebody. So that was very effective for me. Yeah.
Diane.
I have a few scattered thoughts as you were talking, and I've always been impressed with people who have lost husbands or people close to them, and sometimes the people around them are falling apart, and somehow they seem to be able to hold it together. And I've always admired that. It doesn't mean they're not grieving, but somehow they seem to hold it together. And I know they go through all the stages, but sometimes it's the little losses and you were talking about all the emotions like anger and frustration, and sometimes it's the little losses, like losing your phone, which I did yesterday, or my credit card, which I misplaced yesterday, or looking at my roses that are blooming so beautifully in the front, and it makes me sad because I know they're going to start dying. So it's those kinds of little things. And I know personally, I kind of defend myself against loss with people because I keep people at a distance. I don't allow myself to get close enough, or either they to me or me to them. And somehow I think it's a defense for me that if I don't get too close and I don't love too much, then when I lose that person, it won't be so bad, you know? So I'm aware of that in myself. Anyway, you brought up a lot of feelings and thoughts for me with your talk. And one day my gardener was here and he was digging a little hole in the backyard. And I said, oh, what are you doing? He said, oh, I found a dead squirrel. He said, whenever I'm working in the garden anywhere and I find a dead animal, I always dig a little hole and I bury the animal. And then he took a little rock and he put it like a little headstone. And I was so touched by that. And I went out and I put a flower by the rock in the garden. So there are rituals around loss as well. And it's part of the whole process, I think, of accepting and embracing. Anyway, thank you for your, for me, a provocative talk.
Rohan.
Hi. Thanks, Vanessa, for your talk. I just wanted to share about loss and how, in my observation, how it relates to memory and perhaps like impulse. What Dainuri mentioned, regarding the memory, I personally feel that a loss is the image that I get in my mind is a sort of like a someone drumming a drum, and the waves of that drum, they stay far longer than what for how long you might hear them. And that's the sort of frequency that, you know, if you are in that specific context, you might hear that again. And I feel the same with the words also, that like specific words have their own value and significance. So when stored, on the surface, they seem very unharmful, or they seem not getting the right word, but they seem very as if they don't have any value, I guess. But they do take a deeper root in memory, and without our realization, without us being conscious of it, they act. So they have some certain charge, and same with the emotions. So that charge is in operation without us being conscious of it. So given the life situations, the body or the memory acts itself. And more often than not, like, I don't think we are conscious of it. And that's the sort of force that memory carries, which maybe could be interpreted as impulse. And I observe that in myself. And so then people also develop like different, all sorts of coping mechanisms to cope up with that sort of charge that is coming through and acting through you. I suppose a feeling of loss is also that also has some sort of charge, and when it expresses itself without you being aware, you try to oppose it or resist it or somehow, you know, cope with it with some, you know, consciously, and that has a conflict with what the force is. So I'm not sure if I'm expressing it, but my feeling is because I am not able to stay with it, stay with what is coming up through that impulse from the memory. If I do, that has a resolution somewhere. If I don't, then there is a perpetual conflict. So that's what I wanted to share.
Thank you, Rohan. What do you think, what is it that helps us to be able to stay with it? Or at least in your experience?
I have tried to think and meditate on it, but I'm not so sure. It seems just like the whole daily life, that not being in order, that has some toll on it. Like what enables me to stay with something and just witness it as is expression of all of my daily life in that moment. I mean, right from the way I eat and way I sleep and all of that to all my relationships. Staying with something, I mean, apart from when I'm sitting, that's like daily life. That's what I think.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.